Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, Nebraska Senator Deb Fischer joins the show to discuss the fate of year-round E15 and the Farm Bill in the Senate. But first, here are this week's headlines. A bilateral meeting between President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping yielded beneficial ag outcomes. China committed to buy at least $17 billion of U.S. agricultural commodities each year for the next 3 years, on top of a soybean purchase commitment China agreed to in October. In addition to those purchases, the administration separately secured commitments to revive poultry and beef exports. The cornerstone of the U.S.-China negotiations is the establishment of a Board of Trade and Board of Investment to offer a government-to-government forum for officials to foster cooperation on trade and investment. More than 100 lawmakers called for a probe into unfair trade practices from sugar-producing countries. In a letter to U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer, a bipartisan group of 109 lawmakers argue that imports of foreign, subsidized sugar are threatening U.S. producers. The group requested that USTR utilize Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974 to launch a trade probe to protect American sugar beet and sugarcane farmers, processors, refiners, and factory workers. Such a probe would allow the administration to counter unfair trade practices by imposing tariffs or revoking trade privileges after an investigation. Legislation to allow year-round sales of E15 passed the full House and now heads to the Senate. I asked Nebraska Senator Deb Fischer how she sees it faring in the upper chamber.
You know, well, first of all, I really want to congratulate the House members and especially our Nebraska delegation. Congressman Smith, I have been leading this push for over a decade. And so Adrian Smith was a big part of getting that passed in the House. And now we just need to use that momentum and keep moving forward here in the Senate. We're having discussions with every member. In fact, at the Republican lunch the other day, we had really the first robust discussion on E15 at our conference lunch. So I think, we're dispelling a lot of those myths that are out there that this is a mandate. We all know this is not a mandate. There's nothing like that in the bills that I've introduced. This is a choice for consumers. Second, you know, it seems to be this still myth out there talking about how it ruins engines. Not true. Any car that's been manufactured after 2001 can safely use E15. And in fact, 96% of the cars and SUVs and pickups on the road today, they can use E15. So that's what we're trying to get across to our members, make sure they fully understand what we're trying to do here.
Yeah. And Senator, I'd be interested to hear more about the messaging that you mentioned at that Republican lunch. But this legislation, I mean, really faces an uphill battle, needs 60 votes to pass the finish line in the Senate. But what messaging has really resonated with other members as you're talking about this?
You know, I think the main thing is when we look at what's happening in rural America and the issues that are facing our farmers and our ag producers now, that hits home with just about every senator. So to be able to have a market for corn farmers, especially with year-round sale of E15, that's important. And then really to stress how it does help with gas prices. Consumers can have that choice. E15 is cheaper at the pump. Let them have that choice. Again, it is no mandate on gas stations or on usage. But I think it'll be helpful to really push forward with that message so that there's a clear understanding of the benefits. And also to make sure that E15 can be sold year round, it provides that certainty to pass a bill on it, not just to rely on a waiver. And I always say, you know, for the last 8 years, we have seen year-round sale of E15, and Chicken Little is wrong. The sky did not fall.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you yes. asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
The Farm Bill faces an uphill battle, securing the needed 60 votes in the Senate. I asked Nebraska Senator Deb Fischer where she sees the Farm Bill fights playing out in the upper chamber.
Well, we just had a meeting yesterday with the committee. The full committee met to start that discussion on both sides, where we need to come together, because we need to come together here in the Senate. We have to make sure that we can get a Farm Bill passed and be able to also work with the House on that. I think it's especially important to show that unity and understanding, once again, to benefit our farmers, to benefit our rural communities. We have to have that buy-in. That's important. The House did a good job. We'll pick up on that. There's a number of bills in the Senate that we want to include. Chairman Bozeman has been very, very open about that. Yesterday, he mentioned quite a few of the bills that members on both sides of the aisle have out there that we can put into a farm bill because they're good bills. Some of those are mine, dealing with precision agriculture. I have a lot of support on that to be able to help make that technology available to small farmers and ranchers, and so they can benefit from the technology and help their bottom line.
Yeah, and as we wrap up here, Senator, just tragic wildfires burned across the western part of Nebraska earlier this spring. I mean, just horrible seeing the photos and videos that came out of that. But would like an update from you on, you know, how that ground is recovering. And there'd been Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins had teased that there might be some flexibility in USDA programs to better support those producers in that area. But maybe an update on that as well.
These fires were devastating. It was the largest fire in the history of the state of Nebraska and the ninth largest in the United States, in the history of the United States. About 900,000 acres burned. This was mostly in the sand hills of Nebraska that it happened. I was down there about a week as they got control over those fires, about a week after they started. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to meet with these ranchers, farmers, and the stress that they feel. The issue right now is we're in a drought here in Nebraska. Much of the West is in a drought. So we are in a drought. Haven't seen much rain at all. About an inch or so scattered came through the burned area and north of that area. But it's blowing sand. In the sand hills can recover because of the strong root system we have with our diverse grasses there. But we need the moisture, and we are about over the edge right now. So that's very, very stressful for those communities. I had a bill. We passed it by unanimous consent the day after I returned from visiting the area in Nebraska that was burned. It would help streamline and expedite the disaster payments, offer some flexibility there for our ranchers to be able to get those disaster payments early rather than later. I mean, they have hundreds of miles of fence to put in. They have to find feed for cattle. It is desperate conditions. We're hoping the House would be able to pick up my bill and get that done, because it does address the needs we face in Nebraska, and we'll continue to work on that.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Honecke looks at U.S. ethanol exports in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Fuel ethanol is a major U.S. agricultural export. This chart shows total gallons exported in the top destinations for American fuel ethanol between corn marketing years 2015 to 2025, according to USDA. Corn marketing years start in September and end in August. You can see Brazil was once a top importer of American fuel ethanol, but its imports have fallen since increasing production of their own. Canada has since taken the lead, rising from 322 million gallons in 2020 to 758 million gallons in the 2024-25 year. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put four kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Food and Ag Issue Summit in California. The event will offer participants a full day of presentations and panel discussions. You can hear from members of the California Legislature, food and agriculture leaders, along with industry experts and academics. The summit takes place June 2nd in Sacramento. See the latest information and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
Welcome back. Greg Dowd served as chief ag negotiator during the first Trump administration and now is president and CEO of the National Milk Producers Federation. I asked him about his key takeaways from the meeting between President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping.
I was a little PTSD, maybe a little bit, to think about how much work goes into one of those meetings. You know, in 2019, it was 33 negotiating sessions to fix 57 different things in ag. And, you know, trade enhanced a lot, but there was a lot of engagement, a lot of work went into that. And so what I can imagine is that what most people didn't really understand or see was all of the conversations that went into leading up to that meeting. And I think the key thing here that we have to keep in mind is that it takes a lot of engagement, especially between the U.S. and China, to get the outcomes that either country wants. And we went many, many years here where there was 0.0 engagement between our two countries. And that's a huge tragedy, especially for us in agriculture, because China is the biggest importer of food in the world. We're the biggest exporter. A lot of mutual interest there. And so it's really, I'm really happy to see that the level of engagement is back up and running again. A lot of work has gone by and a lot of work yet to do.
Another part of those negotiations was that China renewed over 400 beef facility registrations. This comes at a time when the domestic beef supply is already very tight and the administration is looking at expanding U.S. beef imports to bring down prices for consumers. And when you look at this situation, does the U.S. even have beef to export to China or really any country?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer is what we export isn't what we consume domestically. So I don't think it really it has a great impact on what the producer gets for his price, but it doesn't really affect what's going on in terms of the grocery store or meat case in the United States at all. China buys things like short plates and outside skirts and an awful lot of variety meats or offals or organ meats or whatever you want to say. We sell a lot of mountain chain tripe to China. Well, what, that's stomach. Well, wouldn't you buy stomach in the U.S. when you go to the grocery store? No, nobody eats stomach in the U.S., but those are the things that we export to China at a great value. And the cool thing about that is when China's in the market, they're bidding against the Koreans and the Japanese for the same cut, which creates a little competition in the market, and it's a great thing for the producers.
Greg, you're an excellent person to discuss this topic because you led the negotiations through the historic China Phase One deal during Trump's first term when you were serving as chief ag negotiator. I mean, what's different about this negotiation with China compared to those that, that you led during Trump's first term?
Well, I think the key thing to remember is we sorted almost all of this stuff out in the Phase One agreement. In terms of the plant relistings, that was all in the agreement. But when you let the thing atrophy and you don't engage and you don't talk, this is what Chinese bureaucrats are going to do, is they're going to begin to look the other way and forget about it. That's on us. We got to engage with our trading partner and say, hey, you know, this is the deal. You got to live up to it. And I think I give an enormous amount of credit to my successor, Ambassador Julie Callahan, worked with her very closely when I was there, is when she was a career person at USDR. Now she's the ambassador. She is unbelievable. And I think just we're really lucky to have somebody like that in the job that knows China, speaks Mandarin, knows the situation very, very well. And I think there's a lot of respect for her on the Chinese side as well.
And after this meeting, China committed to buying at least $17 billion in U.S. ag products annually. That comes in addition to the soybean pledge that they made last fall. Given that China never really lived up to the phase one commitments, are you confident that now Beijing will follow through on these new pledges?
You know, I've heard that for years, that China never lived up. I don't agree with that at all. We increased U.S. ag exports by the numbers that I remember from 26 to 38 billion. If you look at the numbers on ag trade and the way the deal was designed, it was 80 billion over 2 years. We came really close in ag to doing that. In fact, we did a lot better in ag than we did in any of the other purchase commitment kind of stuff. So it wasn't perfect, but it was a huge success by any measure, in my opinion. And so the honest answer is, this is kind of the way that China likes to do this. They like to manage their trading relationships with other countries. Okay, well, let's sit down and figure out a way to do that that's a benefit to both of us.
And outside of those ag purchase commitments, one of the biggest takeaways from that meeting was the establishment of a board of trade and board of investment for U.S. and Chinese government officials to have better collaboration. How does this differ from previous venues for economic cooperation? And are you optimistic that it could really have a meaningful impact in improving that relationship between U.S. and Chinese officials?
Well, there's no question this is a new and different and novel idea. And it's interesting. To me, what it is just another way to engage with your trading partner, another way to have a conversation as you're going along saying, hey, this is working well. Hey, this isn't. This is a trading relationship that takes a lot of tender love and care. And that's what they expect when they do business with you. It is about relationships when you're doing business with China. I can assure you this. And it takes a long time to get that going. And then you got to stay with it. You can't be in and out and go, you know, 4 years without talking to you. That killed us, guys. We got to get back in the game.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put 4 kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. We're heading west from Washington to California for a closer look at the new Ag Tech Center, Reservoir Farms. Tammy Arender has a report from the field.
Rows of leafy greens stretch across Salinas Valley in Northern California. This area is commonly known as the Salad Bowl. But with labor and water challenges, feeding the future means doing more with less. And that's where Reservoir Farms comes in, bringing together technology and specialty crop growers. Danny Bernstein, founder and CEO, says this ag tech center is designed to bring innovation straight to the field, pairing real working farms with cutting-edge startups and global partners.
The ideal way to do this was to provide startup space that was adjacent to a farm. And it happens that those two things coming together, a startup incubator, really a prototyping studio, which you're going to see in a few minutes, a prototyping studio adjacent to a working farm doesn't exist anywhere in the world, specifically for the purpose of startups.
Companies like John Deere signed up early on, wanting to invest in the vision of Bernstein, seeing the benefits of having a front row seat with the growers and startups that will advance the next generation of technology.
We feel that the technology that Danny's bringing into this is going to do exactly that, and we can do it faster. We can do it faster, we can fail faster, we can pivot, we can then redirect and continue on. And you're going to have real-time, real-life solutions make it way into their operations.
The new site features multiple innovation barns and 24 acres of dedicated commercial test fields, creating the most concentrated ecosystem of technology leaders, growers, and startups anywhere in agriculture. One of the ground-level businesses is Western Growers, giving them a strategic position of connecting the local farmer with the innovation hub, which will be testing the newest in automation equipment to help get their crops in and out of the field.
They want the startups tested. They want the startups tested in commercial grow. Reservoir does that. And the growers also get startups who can get time and money savings on the way to MVP or Product 1.0. So that more startups can make it to commercialization. So that's the win, is.
And that brings in automation entrepreneurs like Trick.
What we're doing here at Thoughtfloor is getting the boots in the dirt. Really, it's not just the space, but also the community that we're building here around farmers and strategics, helping educate the startups about how it is to build on the farm and how it is to launch technology in real farming conditions. And I think that was something that was really missing before this. And because of that, there was a lot of building and then bringing it to farms, sending farmers time, and not getting something that would be really valuable for them.
Reservoir Farms is also teaming up with local higher education institutions like Hartnell College and the University of California. Michael Gutierrez of Hartnell says his institution has the only mechatronics program in the state of California.
Part of our mission, or our mission at Hartnell College, is to advance economic and social mobility to our students and to our region. And what you're going to see is that mission in action with all our partners.
Reservoir Farms is starting with 12 resident partners, 6 that will be on site full time. One of those companies has come all the way from the Netherlands, which specializes in automated weeding.
I think the interest in weeding alternatives is definitely there. And for two reasons, people don't like to use too much herbicides. And of course, labor is also getting difficult. So those, I think, are the two key reasons for people to look into alternative measures. And then, yeah, our laser weeding solution perfectly fits that.
Challenges facing agriculture, like climate pressures, labor shortages, and rising input costs, are forcing agriculture to evolve, and fast. And that's why folks like Norm Groot, head of Monterey County Farm Bureau, says a place like Reservoir Farms is vital to the industry's future.
And I think the balance will be how we manage labor going forward. And if we have an extreme labor shortage or something happens with labor, this may make all this tech a lot more easier to swallow as an investment.
So in this case, reservoir may not mean a collected body of water, but more of its secondary meaning, a collection of resources. Resources that will mean success for growers and Reservoir Farms.
Are we accelerating high impact solutions? That's the only thing, that's our North Star, technology as resilience. And so are we helping facilitate solutions that accelerate resilience?
I'm Tammy Arender for AgriPulse.
Want to hear from Reservoir Farms CEO Danny Bernstein and take a closer look at California's ag issues? Register to join us for the AgriPulse Food and Ag Issues Summit in Sacramento on Tuesday, June 2nd. We'll cover it all: weather, politics, data centers, regenerative agriculture, and global disruptions impacting California agriculture. It's an event food and ag leaders can't afford to miss.
For 35 years, soybean farmers have invested together to build demand for U.S. soy at home and around the world. Through the Soy Checkoff, farmers turn every dollar into stronger markets for U.S. soybeans, driving innovation and partnerships across feed, food, fuel, sustainable production, and beyond, led by farmers and built to last. U.S. Soy, 35 years of delivering value back to the farm and investing in the future of agriculture.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Both the House and Senate are in recess next week, and USDA's crop progress report will be released on Monday. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.